Hello, this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable, and we're here to give you tips for you and your family to make your lives easier. My special guest this evening is Dr. Preston Gelhart. He is the chair and professor of forensic psychology at Argosy University in Orange, California. Welcome, Dr. Gelhart. How are you?
Been a nice day today.
It has been a nice day today. Yeah, it's been gorgeous in Southern California, so we're very fortunate. So we are going to be talking a little bit about mood disorders this evening. And before we get started, could you tell the listening audience about your background?
Yes, I have a doctoral degree from USC, and prior to coming to Argosy, I was on faculty at Pepperdine University for 30 years. And while there, I conducted applied clinical research studies treating people who presented with depression and sometimes comorbid with accompanying anxiety.
And yeah, I saw a little bit of your research when I met you initially, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that research this evening, correct?
Yes, that will be fine.
Wonderful. That's fantastic. The first thing I would like to ask you is, are there different types of depression, and they're sometimes referred to as mood disorders?
Yes, Julianne, there are, and I do prefer to use the expression mood disorders, because depression itself constitutes one diagnostic category. And so when we're talking about mood disorders, there's an array of different types of disorders that would include unipolar depression. Usually that's a major depression. Also bipolar depression, and that's where a person vacillates between being very manicky and quite depressed. There's also a milder form of depression called dysthymia. And then double depression is when the individual has experienced both dysthymia and major depression.
And those
So there are a number of different things to discuss in terms of those different categories. And I think it'll also be helpful to your readers, your listeners, to attend a little bit to how there are gender differences in forms of mood disorders and different types of treatments that are typically used effectively in working with mood disorders.
Yes, so there's a lot of material out there to be talking about and sifting through. And I know that there was just a recent rewrite of what's called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and that's our Bible in the psychology profession. That is what we go to when clinicians need to diagnose somebody. So there, it's kind of a recipe in a way for, you know, to take down the symptoms of a client or a patient and then try to sift through and figure out exactly what's going on with that person, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Julianne. In fact, the DSM-4-TR, which is the manual that has just recently gone through revision, replaced by the DSM-5, and the different diagnostic symptoms guide a treatment specialist in terms of rendering a diagnosis so that a treatment program can be prescribed.
Right, and that's really important, especially if the client or patient eventually needs some medication, because, you know, it gives the medical doctor something to work off of. It gives the psychology profession and the medical profession a common language that they can understand.
Yes, that's true. And I think that depression is often treated with medications. However, there has been some body of literature suggesting that a form of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy is as effective or more effective with many different forms of both major depression and dysthymia.
And can you tell us a little bit of what CBT is about, the cognitive behavioral therapy?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is particularly interested in what I'll call the reciprocal relationship between a person and the way that they think and the way that they feel, between the environment in which they live and the behavior that they're able to manifest. So this reciprocal relationship will determine basically the type of disorder that may be present and also guides us in terms of how to treat this individual, moving them toward a more balanced form of living.
So when you first see a client and they're presenting with depression, what is your general your general know-how and what you do with a client when they first present?
Well, we're particularly interested in not only gathering diagnostic information about them relative to the diagnostic statistical manual, but we're also very interested in interviewing them regarding the type of environment in which they live. We observe the behaviors that they're manifesting, and we do want to talk with them about the way that they think about their life experiences. There's a noted psychiatrist by the name of Aaron Beck who has done a great deal of research in the area of treating people that present with depression. And Beck established a triangle where he referred to depressogenic cognitions. Beck was primarily interested in cognition, but he also realized the importance of behavior, so that was part of his treatment. But what Beck initially looked at was the relationship between self the individual has of themselves and the situation in which they find themselves. He's interested in what they think about their future and whether they're quite negative and hopeless about the future. And he's also interested in what they think about their environment and other people in the environment. And the depressogenics that we find here is usually referred to as a negative triad. This triad interaction between self, environment, and future. And so as a treatment specialist, I'm particularly interested in gathering information about that because I typically can identify that the individual is in an environment that has a very low rate of positive reinforcement, a low rate of being recognized as being a favorable person by others, the individual's receiving information and reinforcement from his place of employment. His socialization is usually positive. But when an individual is experiencing the mood disorder, that's where we find that there's a low rate of positive reinforcement. And equally, there's a high rate of aversive experiences, wherein the individual cannot hold a job, he's going through a divorce, he's experiencing substance abuse problems. And this also will lead toward dysphoria and forms of depression.
And that can happen within a relatively short amount of time, correct? Or is this kind of a buildup of symptoms and not getting the positive reinforcement from the environment, from your family and friends and workplace?
Mm-hmm. Much of our literature suggests that this occurs over a period of time. For example, for a diagnosis of dysthymia, the mood disorder must have been present for 2 years or longer. For major episodes of depression, they have a little more rapid onset, but they again exist based upon coming from a dysfunctional environment and a dysfunctional social relationship.
And isn't it also experiencing depression pretty much every day?
Yes, in milder forms like dysthymia, that is a continuous period of dysphoria, which is another word that we use when we're talking about dysphoric feelings or emotional feelings. And the severity is typically not quite as bad. If you kind of conceptualize the globe and you look at the equator as being a normal mood level, dysthymics will drop down below that equator a few degrees, and they will remain in that position for some time. A person with major depression will take a major drop in their dysphoria, and it becomes more obvious as you conceptualize it from the globe perspective. This globe will also be handy to us if we get around to talking about bipolar depression, because you will see that in this case, the moods elevate up into a manic-y stage and then take a dive bomb down into the South Pole. So we're looking at a comparison between bipolar, North Pole, and South Pole.
So with bipolar depression, can it manifest as that a person may be starting off with a picture of depression, and then he or she is sitting and trying to compensate for not wanting to stay in that state, being uncomfortable with it. And so they start behaving in the opposite manner. Does it look like that kind of a picture?
I think that that's a good way to begin to consider bipolar. However, there's some evidence that bipolar is much more chemical than major depression. And so it's not so matter a voluntary attempt to pull yourself out of a depression that results in the manic-y behaviors, but rather it has more to do with the chemical imbalance that the person is experiencing.
So it's more of a natural onset then, is that right?
Yes, we think it is, though it's certainly influenced by the environment.
What kind of environmental factors would feed into a person becoming bipolar?
Well, they may have their initial onset, as you indicated, in terms of depression itself. But the environmental conditions, we're not too sure what may necessarily cause the mood elevation up to a manic-y level. There is some evidence that there are genetic involvement, that in some way they may have inherited this. And certainly it requires long-term treatment for the bipolar depression. In my work, I worked only with what I call unipolar depression, and that is conditions of dysthymia, double depression, and major depression. I did not find that the treatment intervention I used was particularly effective in working with bipolar.
That's interesting. How so?
Well, primarily because we were activating people in their environment to become more involved in pleasant activities, and bipolars tend to be much more rebellious, acting out, and very difficult sometimes to deal with. And so you're not going to get a lot of compliance from them while they're in a manic-y state.
Right. And then isn't it also difficult to keep a bipolar person into therapy on a consistent basis?
Yes, it's very difficult.
So when you were working with unipolar dysthymia, double depression, did you use kind of the same methodology, or were there differences in the therapy techniques that you used?
No, the interventions basically were the same for people, irrespective of the diagnosis, whether it was major depression, dysthymia, or double depression. And remember, about 75% of our clients were also what we call comorbid with anxiety. And so we had an intervention that also worked towards trying to reduce their anxiety levels so they could better participate in other kinds of activities. We try to involve them in increasing their pleasant activities. We comprised a list of activities that they had found pleasant in the past, and we began to encourage them to participate more in those at this time and in the future. We also have found that many times as people are feeling depressed, they withdraw a little bit from a potentially reinforcing environment and gathering of social friends. So we found that they also benefited from being taught assertiveness training. Many times people who are experiencing some form of mood disorder, particularly a depressive mood disorder, have difficulty with social skills, again, because they're a bit resident in terms of their social interactions. So we, again, enforce with them the importance of smiling, of making eye contact, to shaking hands. And sometimes you simply role play this in a small group setting, which we had.
Yeah, so group therapy in that case would be really beneficial, I would imagine.
What I found is that group therapy was just as effective and sometimes more effective than individual therapy. And typically my groups ranged in numbers from 6 to 10.
Yeah, so I like your method, Dr. Gelhart, of teaching them new coping skills, teaching them new social skills, and
that's correct. You have used the correct word, coping. In fact, this particular intervention uses a textbook as well as a workbook, and it becomes like an educational experience during all of our group sessions. And the name of the textbook is Coping with Depression. We find that if we can, in fact, enable people to learn how to better cope with their environment, it's more likely they're going to receive more reinforcement and not become as depressed. In my research, which was over about a 12-year period of time, we found that 100% of our clients presented with depression. They were diagnosed with depression. At the conclusion of our small group intervention, which was 12 individual small group sessions, 100% of our clients experienced mood elevation, and 80% of them were no longer diagnosed with depression.
Wow, those are fabulous numbers.
And these figures are not simply the results of my work. They also have been the work of Dr. Peter Lewinson from the University of Oregon, who in fact is the person responsible for basically developing this particular intervention. And we also found that in addition to mood elevation, we noticed a lot of anxiety reduction.
Yeah, and they seem to go hand in hand, is that right?
They seem to co-present, yes. Whether you are working with a person with a primary diagnosis of anxiety, they will have about the same percentage of depression. So basically, when you're going to do an intervention for a person that is presenting with either anxiety or depression, your intervention should be sensitive to the additional diagnosis, or at least the potential of that additional diagnosis.
Right, and that requires sometimes more digging with the client and more sessions, because it takes a while to really get to know a person and to start peeling off the layers of the onion, the psychological onion. So how long, now you were saying for the group therapy, how many sessions were that again?
We had 12 sessions, 12 two-hour sessions, and they were dispersed over 2 months.
Wow, that's pretty intense. So
yes, it's a very intense intervention.
Yes.
And we also had assignments that they had to complete every day outside of therapy sessions themselves. And upon their return, they would have to review with us what they had experienced during that time.
That's great. And also with the group therapy, that gets them out of the isolation mode, which is so prevalent with people who are experiencing depression. A lot of people just want to go home, hide out, whatever, and just, you know, escape from the world, essentially. So, yeah, group therapy would be wonderful.
It's a very effective intervention. As I say, it is as effective and sometimes more effective than individual therapy.
Yes, so Dr. Gelhart, we are going to be taking a short break here. You take a breather, and we will come back and start talking about mood disorders again. I would like to let the listeners know also that if they would like to see me for therapy, I have my office in Cerritos, California. My phone number is 562-234-4650. My email is jgoode8@verizon.net. Please contact me for anything that you would like to talk about, discuss, and anything about the show or therapy. And we will be coming back after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good and Dr. Preston Gelhart. We are talking about mood disorders. And Dr. Gelhart, you were speaking before about the gender differences with mood disorders. Can you discuss that a little bit, please?
Yeah, this is, I think, a very important area for people to become aware of in terms of issues of mood disorders. We see that females seem to present with a higher prevalence for depression than males. And within the general population for females, we're looking at 8 to 9%. For males, 4 to 5%. Now, there's quite a bit of discussion on this issue. The strongest position that I've identified is that females are more apt to present for treatment for feeling a mood disorder. And they are more apt to benefit from the therapeutic intervention. Males, on the other hand, are somewhat remiss at coming in for depression, seeking treatment. And when they do, they typically do not benefit quite as much over a long period of time as females do. But they're more apt to turn to drinking alcohol or becoming involved in some kind of coping activity that many times is antisocial. I can tell you, based upon data from my particular study, that men and women presented with about equal levels of depression. Their responsiveness to the intervention was about the same. And I did testing not only at pre-test, but also post-test, and then 1, 6, 12, and 18, and 24 months thereafter. So I gathered information on the effectiveness of the intervention. At 18 months, men began to show a slight increase in levels of depression. And at 24 months, they again were symptomatic for depression, whereas females continued to show a reduction in their mood disorders. So where we have a lot of empirical data based upon my work as well as that of others, we still recognize that it may be an environmental or a social factor that is the difference between. I have no data in terms of why at 24 months my men were again symptomatic for depression. All I know is that was the testing results that I acquired.
So that you bring up a good point about men and mood disorders and seeking treatment for that. Mm-hmm. There is a socialization component to it. There's the stigma of a lot of men probably don't want to say to somebody, hey, you know what, I'm having problems here. I needed to go seek some counseling. I needed to get some help. Did you come across that quite a bit when you were doing your research?
Yes, I think that when we did our intake interviews, we identified that these were male clients that were coming to us as almost like a last resort. These were, by the way, other measures that we looked at included attempted suicides, suicide ideation, substance abuses, divorces. We looked at quite a few what we call social demographic information. And men clearly were presenting as though this is their last resort.
Yeah, which is sad. I mean, I think a lot of men get up to that point where, you know, they get up to a wall and it's one route or the other. So
I also found that in general, females were more compliant with the intervention and completing their homework assignments.
So I know that there's more research and studying going on with, you know, doing therapy with men and constructing some type of therapy that's going to be just specifically geared towards them so that, mm-hmm. you know, especially dealing with the resistance and the, you know, what it means to be a man. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not sure that I have any data that I can report to you regarding that idea. I just know that the intervention that I have used and has been used by other people has been particularly effective in working with this particular grouping of diagnostic categories.
Mm-hmm. And does it seem for men that group therapy approach is more effective than personal therapy?
Well, the literature does not necessarily support that. But I think probably because there's more individual therapy going on in these research centers than there will be group therapy. But the comparative studies that have been done indicate that the group therapy is as effective.
Okay, and have you done any research on, you know, the gender differences? Since women experience depression more than men do, have there been any studies that you've seen and that it could possibly be also a hormonal component to that?
There could very well be. There certainly will be hormonal differences between males and females. I'm not familiar with any particular literature at this point on that idea.
And also, what about depression differences in age groups?
Well, that too is an area of interest. And we're finding that there's a higher prevalence of depression in younger age groups today than we often thought there was in the past. Some recent data suggests that nearly 10% of the age group 18 to 25 are presenting with depression. There is a prevalence level at that 10% factor. Whereas in the older groups, like 50 plus and above, here the percentage is about 5%. So there seems to be some difference in terms of the younger group experiencing more depression than they did a few years ago. And I know in one of my discussions with you, you hypothesized that this may in fact be the baby boomer phenomenon coming through. I think there's no doubt that environmental changes, environmental social changes, do have a major effect upon the occurrence of mental health problems.
Right, and as we were discussing personally yesterday, just the seesawing of the economy still right now since 2008, and people having to shift what they really need in terms of just sheer survival, and having to maybe move in with family or move in with friends or move into a house and have five or six people living in that household. I mean, it seems like it's really shifted lately.
Well, I think it has. I was watching the Today Show this morning, and they had a brief news report on the increase of young adults between the ages of 20 and 30 returning home to live with the parents. They've graduated from universities. They cannot get a job. They're having to move home and live with the parents. And though they're well-educated, they're unable to get a job in their area of education, and they're working at grocery stores and restaurants.
Right. They're working way below what their education level
is. Exactly.
I know. I've got a household that's doing that right now. So,
right.
Yes. So I know that one personally. So, yeah, there you go. Especially since when young people are in school, they are expected, they're putting in their time, they're putting in their studies, they are paying a lot of money for their education, and they get out of school, and then eventually Sally Mae's breathing down their next 6 months later saying, okay, guess what, you get to start paying back your student loans, and they're working at minimum wage jobs. They have to move back with their parents. There doesn't really leave them a whole lot of options. So therefore, what did they do with their educations in the meantime? Everything's kind of still on hold. That can definitely wreak havoc with a person's stability in their moods, period. So can you talk a little bit about that age category, the 18 to 25, and why the increase in the depression level now from the research that you've done?
Well, I had a very limited number of people in that particular age group. My age group is really varied between 27 to 28 up through into the 70s. So I don't have a lot of personal data in terms of that issue. I think that there's a rather unusual social phenomena going on in this country. And certainly one of them is the violence that we're seeing with our adolescents in high schools. And I may not have mentioned to you before, but I also am an expert witness in the area of education and student supervision.
Oh.
And strangely enough, I'm seeing quite a number of new cases that are dealing with sexual molestations and harassments. I've been doing this for about 30 years, and I did not have that kind of client load 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, as I'm seeing now. And so being a cognitive behavioral therapist, of course, I tend to be somewhat sensitive to environmental events. And I can't quite put my finger on, at this time, what seems to be causing this, except some kind of a deterioration in the family unit itself. Perhaps as a marriage and family therapist, you've had some observations of this type.
Yes.
But clearly, we need to be more sensitive to issues of what is happening in terms of violence with our children, and we need to find out more about the characteristics of these children who have acted out and actually been shooting and murdering people.
Yeah, that has been one of my utmost concerns about what's happening with the society right now. And I've had a few programs on that with other forensic psychologists, and just trying to pick through what exactly is happening, especially from you know, from what I've researched so far, it's between the 20 and 30-year-old white male group. What happened there? It doesn't quite make sense why that is a prevalent age group, and I have no idea. You know, of course, there's the theory about we're desensitized to violence in this country now because you see it on TV, video games, almost every one of them has some kind of violent component to it. You go on YouTube, you can see people fighting and people think it's entertainment now. I don't know. There's so many different avenues as to how we ended up getting at this point.
Yes, that's true enough. A very renowned psychologist by the name of Albert Bandura is the one that developed a social learning theory, and he was of the opinion that TV was responsible for a lot of the violence that we were seeing in our children.
Yeah,
it's being modeled for them right there.
Right, and for how many generations now? At least two or three now, because I mean, I think. TV really started to become violent when, how many years ago? I would say approximately 30 years ago.
I've been watching it that long.
Yeah, it seems that it's increased more and more. There's more crime shows. There's more reality-based shows where if there's not at least one fighting scene within that reality show, they really don't want to air it. And it's ridiculous. That the media is pushing this as entertainment.
Yes, I agree with you, and I can't help but think about the family of these children that have become violent, and here we're discussing issues of depression and mood disorders. You could readily imagine what it must be like to be a parent of either the victim or the perpetrator of these kinds of acts.
It's horrible.
This in and of itself is setting up an environment that is creating major mental health problems, and certainly mood disorders is one of them.
Yeah, along with paranoia.
Yes.
Yeah, across the board. I mean, when you look at the news and everything else, I mean, I think that there's more elements of paranoia that are cropping up across society, especially after a mass shooting, and it just creates more fear across the board. So, Dr. Gellhart, is depression responsive to therapeutic interventions?
Yes, it is. As I said, 100% of my people presented with diagnosed depression. And at the conclusion of the intervention and in follow-up out to 24 months, only the males again became mildly depressed. And up until that was only at the 24-month period. And at the other follow-up intervals, the intervention was shown to be effective. They no longer were symptomatic for depression. They had learned life skills that enabled them to use your expression or Lewinson's to cope with events in their lives. They had learned the skills of being able to act in a way that did not attract aversiveness. They had learned to think in a more positive way about their families and other people whom they know. And they had learned how to use skills that enable them to better control their feelings. Relaxation, and I encourage everyone to practice relaxation on a regular basis.
So important.
To learn assertiveness skills so that you're standing up for your rights. Not necessarily that it means being aggressive, but rather you're being assertive and saying, well, wait a minute, I have a right to expect this to happen. And so as they have learned these skills, as I say, 80% of my clients were no longer presenting with symptoms of depression. And I was quite impressed with those findings. And I might also mention to you that though I'm primarily referring to the adult male and female populations in terms of mood disorders. We also conducted a study of the geriatric clients and found that, again, they responded quite well to the interventions that they were taught. And they did not necessarily present with as much depression as the typical adult population did.
That's important because, especially in the geriatric population, loneliness is sometimes a daily factor within a lot of that population. So to be able to combat that and to have the skills available so that they can cope with it and reach out and do other things other than, you know, sinking into their loneliness is so important.
Mm-hmm. Most of our clients were in retirement homes, which was a population we were particularly interested in. I might, as a side thought, I might mention to you that my wife is currently finishing her dissertation, and she was interested in mental health characteristics of the homeless who resided on the street and the homeless that resided in homeless shelters. And depression was certainly one of the issues that she was measuring. And quite naturally, given the more in the sheltered area where you have more of a socialization factor present, they were not experiencing quite as much depression as those people working on the streets, walking on the streets.
That must be incredible work, and kudos to your wife. That's wonderful. So just briefly, can we touch upon medication as an effective intervention for the treatment of depression?
Yes, I think meditation has a place in our therapeutic interventions. Though I personally have been working as a cognitive behavioral therapist, that doesn't mean that I've closed my eyes to other forms of intervention. And I think meditation is very valuable. I remember when we went through a period where, what was it called, tea meditation or something of that nature, but we practiced our medication 20 minutes a day. And meditation, at least as I learned it, also incorporated being relaxed and practicing different relaxation procedures. I still do so. I know four specific relaxation techniques that I always teach my clients that work very effectively for me. I have seen it happen because I've practiced it for so long. I've seen it happen when I'm in an extremely stressful situation. I get the visual imagery that I've meditated about. And I think that when people can get to the point of doing that, they're better equipped to deal with the stresses that they're going to experience, and particularly the unpredictable stresses that may happen. And in our society today, I think that we all have times when something happens we hadn't anticipated at all.
Yes, it seems to be happening more often than not. And to have those techniques at your disposal when you need them is invaluable, especially deep breathing. Yes. I talk about doing deep breathing quite a bit on my show. So, yeah, it's wonderful. Also, what about medication use?
Medication has been used effectively with people presenting with mood disorders. And unfortunately, sometimes it is almost the treatment of choice, because all you have to do is pop a pill and maybe feel better rather than spend hours in therapy. We're such a busy society, and we are so wedded to medical treatments that we overlook the importance of learning a new way of living that will reduce any kind of mood disorders and anxiety disorders that we may be experiencing. But yes, medication has been used effectively. With my clients, if they were on medication when they came into the program, I told them that I'd be happy to work with your prescribing physician if you want to go off of the medications. Otherwise, you can continue on them and you can still be a part of this intervention. I had several people that we did work with that helped take them off of medications, and as far as I know, out to a 2-year period, they were no longer medicated.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. And that's, you know, it's really a case-by-case situation. What may work for one person may not work for another person. And I think
that's
a lot
true.
Of people need to realize that, too, that, and you're right, we've got a society that, you know, pop a pill and make your bad feelings go away, and that's not necessarily the case. A lot of times you have to do the work along with it. Change your perspective, do the CBT work, or do something similar, but make a change. Figure out what is causing you to feel so bad, and then
yes.
changing it, because that, you know, there's so many options for a lot, you know, for a lot of people that sometimes you need to talk to somebody else and say, okay, I'm stuck, so what else do you have that I maybe haven't looked at, and
right.
and start working at a different angle?
Well, some of the data that I gathered had to deal with prior or current medication use, and they both groups, those who were either on or had been using medication, and those who were not, had never been medicated. The people with medications presented with higher levels of depression. At post-test, the people who had never been medicated still presented with lower levels and were asymptomatic for depression, whereas those who did use medications at post-test, they were still experiencing depression at a mild level. And so, to me, it seems that those people who have sought medications have experienced more depression and benefited less from the intervention than those who never had any form of medication.
It's interesting. Yes. Now, Dr.
To me, it seems that the medicated group still are of the opinion that they need the medication to alleviate their depression, and even after the 12-session, 2-month interventions, they're still experiencing mild levels of depression.
Yeah, I've known people like that, where they just kept on the regimen and didn't even think twice about going back and getting that reassessed. And that's important, too. You know, talk to your doctor about,
yes.
you know, what's happening with your symptoms, whether you need to have a change of medication or not. That's really important to keep that dialogue
yes,
going.
Now, yes. Here's another finding that you may be interested in. I found the higher levels of education, the less the clients benefited from the intervention.
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
Remember that this is a cognitive behavioral intervention where mm-hmm. you have homework assignments and behavioral activities in which you must involve yourself. People who have master's degrees and doctoral degrees, and I had several doctoral level people, they did not benefit as much from the intervention, and I'm of the opinion that they said, well, you know, all I have to do is realize how I'm supposed to change, and I don't have to change. I do it cognitively. I can think about it, and I won't feel depressed anymore. And it didn't work for them.
Yeah, it doesn't always go that way, thinking it goes away, right? And you have to do the
right.
work again, yes. So, Dr. Gelhart, as we are wrapping up the last 2 minutes here, is there anything else that you would like to say about mood disorders?
Well, I'm not sure at the moment. We've done a pretty good job of covering the waterfront on this. I know that you have your own private practice and that you are working with people, I'm quite sure, some of whom are presenting with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage you to have them consider alternative forms of intervention if for some reason, and this of course would mean that you would consider using an alternative form of intervention, if for some reason you seem to hit a block. You can't seem to get past a certain place in your therapeutic intervention. And when I've encountered things of that nature, that's when I typically begin to look around and, well, if this is not working, let's look and see what else might work.
Right.
And I always want to encourage clients and therapists that if you have successfully treated a client, you don't terminate that client. You transition that client. You transition them on into support associations, mechanisms, organizations, in which they will continue to receive the positive reinforcement that has also assisted in their recovery.
Yes, that's important. Thank you. And if the listeners would like to contact you, how can they do so?
They can reach me at my telephone number, which is 949-797-0150.
And thank you so much, Dr. Preston Gelhart. It was wonderful information.
Well, thank you, Julianne. It's been a pleasure to talk with you here.
Thank you. And if the listeners would like to contact me again, my business phone number is 562-234-4650. My email is jgood8@verizon.net. You can pull up any archived Psych 101 shows at iTunes and at skidrowstudios.com. I would like to thank my board operator, Jenny Guzman, and the executive producer, Jeremy Hansen. And thank you so much for tuning in to Psych 101. Stay tuned to the Qumran Report on right after me. This has been Julianne Good. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now. Have an idea.